Good evening. This is Mimi Poser at the Guggenheim. Our subject this evening is the work of Vasily Kandinsky, the artist who has been called the father of abstract painting. And our guest tonight is Mr. Thomas M. Messer, the director of the Guggenheim Museum. Kandinsky painted from about 1895 until his death in 1944. For purposes of this program, we will divide his work into four broad periods: the early formative years in Munich, the Russian years, his Bauhaus period, and finally, the Paris years. But before we begin discussing his work, would you, Mr. Messer, tell us something about Kandinsky himself, and particularly about his decision to become a painter?
Well, as you said, Kandinsky was born in 1866, lived as a child in a cultivated environment, had access to all sorts of intellectual expression, was particularly sensitive toward color, loved to play with colors that he squeezed out of pastes and luxuriate in the visual pleasure that this exercise brought about. He was, however, not by any means precocious. The opposite might be said about him. He was preoccupied, perhaps, with visual phenomena, but he certainly was not trained in his early youth as a painter. He was a lawyer, and as such distinguished. He was sent out to undertake some fairly complex legal research projects, and painting remained very much in the back of his mind without really coming to the fore professionally.
It was simply a love, not thought of doing as a career.
It was an avocation, and he was on the verge of formally embracing the legal profession when suddenly, or seemingly suddenly, he decided that he has got to change his life, leave Moscow, and become a student of painting.
Doesn't legend have it that this decision was precipitated by the visit to an Impressionist show in Moscow?
I don't even think it was legend. I think that he did see an Impressionist exhibition in 1895 and was particularly struck by Monet's haystacks, which today, of course, seem to us as highly figurative, but which in their subtlety and in their airiness struck the young Kandinsky as a work sufficiently abstract to give rise to the thought that painting might exist separate from the subject matter. And of course, eventually, Kandinsky's great contribution to the thought of painting was precisely the notion that color and form can exist autonomously, apart from and separated from any subject that it may depict.
Well, I think we're getting ahead of ourselves now. I want to go back to before,
right,
when he went to school in,
right,
Munich, his decision to become a painter.
A painter. Well, that happened in 1896. In other words, Kandinsky was 30 years old, at which time I don't think he could have done anything but student works. I'm not aware of any Kandinsky painting before 1901 or 1902, and even then the beginnings were, let us say, shaky. Had Kandinsky unhappily died, let's say, in 1905 or 1906, it is very doubtful that we would remember his name.
Weren't most of his early works very derivative from the influences around him at that time? The Art Nouveau and Impressionism?
Yes, they were. Of course, this again is not unusual. It is also true of Mondrian, perhaps to a lesser extent of Klee. But the usual thing is that a young painter, and Kandinsky, as we said before, was really not so very young at that stage any longer, newly developing painter can only begin with what is left to him from the outside. And so Kandinsky was doing conventional work.
Wasn't he at a school in Munich?
Yes, he was. he was at a school in which, incidentally, he met some of his more illustrious future colleagues, but they were students and did not know that they were going to play an important part in the history of painting. But even when Kandinsky already began to organize the intellectual community that later led him to become president of various artistic organizations such as the Neue Künstlergesellschaft and the Blaue Reiter, much later, of course. Even at that time, Kandinsky was in his beginnings as a painter.
Didn't he organize a group even before that, the Phalanx?
The Phalanx, yes. And this is what I was referring to. I did not mean to say that he was in the beginning as a painter when he became involved with the Neue Künstlergesellschaft or the Blaue Reiter, at which time, indeed, he was fully developed and a natural leader.
Well, it would seem to me that his genius as a painter and even as an intellectual leader manifested themselves very early, because he did form the Phalanx not too long after he came to Munich. It was about 5-6 years.
Well, that is true. The only explanation for this would be that Kandinsky was intellectually and from a human point of view much more developed than he was as a painter.
At that time?
At that time, yes.
Would you characterize his work at that time, the earliest works that you would describe as being those of a fully developed painter?
Well, let's go before the stage in which he seems to me, at least, as a fully developed painter. Between 1902, roughly, and 1906, the work is conventional, is all I can say. There are little landscapes, little seascapes, sometimes very charming, but certainly nothing very different from what was conventionally painted around him. You would have to go to 1904, 1905, 1906, at a time at which he had already become exposed to the more advanced international developments, particularly in Paris, to find things in Kandinsky which really would make a difference. Obviously, the Fauves, with their use of arbitrary color and the attenuation of forms, had an influence upon Kandinsky's development and upon his thinking. And by, say, 1905-6, Kandinsky painting in a fauvish manner was nevertheless recognizable. Then when he moved to Murnau, I believe in 1908 or 9, he certainly commanded a personal style, still not of revolutionary importance, but certainly something not to be dismissed. The very important development, of course, came early in the second decade of our century. It is difficult to say at this stage whether this was 1910, 11, 12, or 13.
But isn't he supposed to have painted the first non-objective, thoroughly, truly non-objective painting in 1910?
Well, it is frequently said that the first watercolor, which was presumably fully non-objective, was painted in 1910. But first of all, there's a certain degree of scholarly disagreement about this date. Secondly, it is really very difficult to say what is fully non-objective, particularly with Kandinsky, who relied always on subject matter in a hidden form. Even his later abstractions tended to screen, as it were, a subject matter or an objective reality which never fully left him and his thinking, and if you look closely enough, is actually discernible. It would be difficult to say that the Cubists, for instance, were not abstract, even though they did rely on the presence of subject matter. Picasso, Braque, and others never removed themselves fully from the object as a point of departure. Nevertheless, much of what they have done look non-objectively abstract to us. Kandinsky went further than the Cubists and his references to recognizable reality are more disguised, but certainly in his free-form period, which does not end before the beginning of the First World War, the subject, the recognizable and implied content is ever in evidence.
Who would you say were the greatest influences on Kandinsky during this period?
Well, I think this is probably very difficult to say because influences rarely present themselves in a direct and traceable form. Kandinsky's own history is complicated. His Russian birth, his involvement with folklore, his interest in Bavarian folk painting, for instance, he and others, for that matter, amused themselves by painting in back of glass panels, the so-called Hinterglas works, Hinterglas Malerei, of which a number are in the Städtische Galerie in Munich.
We have a charming one.
We have a little one here in the exhibition, that's right. So I would say that all of these ethnic and cultural influences on the one hand, and of course his increasing awareness of the main current of modernism from Paris brought about a development in which the subjective and the objective, the personal and the general, stood in a complicated relationship to one another.
Yes, well, all these relationships are always complicated, but I'm particularly thinking of Marc, with whom he had a close relationship, and Marca.
Well, of course, he had a close relationship with Marc, with Marquet, later with Clay, with many others. But to name these people as having exerted direct influences would be overstating the case, particularly so because among those at that time, Kandinsky was, at least intellectually, the leader rather than the follower.
Kandinsky's early work was very romantic. Would you say that this romanticism carried into his later abstract expressionism? And indeed, I'd like to clarify something myself. Is this period called abstract expressionism? People have so many different names for...
All right, let's see what we can do with your second question first. The term abstract expressionism, as far as I remember, was used with reference to Kandinsky by Alfred Barr. Separately from this, the American post-war movement, Pollock, de Kooning, and others, were at one time called abstract expressionists. From those two separate assumptions, there resulted sometimes the mistaken or at least overstressed assumption that Pollock and de Kooning came out directly from Kandinsky. While it is likely that Pollock and de Kooning would not have been what they have become without Kandinsky, it is equally true that any number of other currents played into their art and that therefore to establish a direct relationship between Kandinsky and Pollock is oversimplifying the case to the point of absurdity. So abstract expressionism with Kandinsky simply meant something rather different than it meant for the post-war school, and in any case, it's a semantic exercise which I think we would be better to stay away from.
Okay, away from it. But can we get back to the romanticism?
That's even more complicated. I think romanticism is a huge term, has too many meanings. I think Kandinsky can be called romantic only in a very general way.
Well, I was thinking in particular of the fairy tale imagery in the very early works and mm-hmm. the folkloric imagery.
Well, there's no question that these things played into his art. There's absolutely no question about this, not only in the early and pictorial phase of his art, but also, if you wish, in subsequent and seemingly abstract phases, there is a preoccupation with color, there is a joy in former play, there is emphatic interaction of lines and planes, which all in some way may be called romantic, but the term is imprecise and I would rather leave it out.
Well, it's time to go on to the next period. World War I began and Kandinsky had to leave Germany.
That's right.
And go to Russia. And I'd like you to discuss these Russian years. One of the things I don't know if many people know is that he was a commissar of art in Russia. Mm-hmm.
Well, since he was a Russian citizen and lived in Munich, he had to leave immediately as an enemy alien when World War I broke out. He traveled through Europe, as you said, to Russia. In 1916, he was in Sweden, I believe, where he broke with Gabriela Münter, his former friend and mistress, and a year later in Russia married Nina. While he was in Russia, there is very little evidence of his work, partly perhaps because of the war years, partly because of the generally unsettled condition in his own life, but surely also because he made available his services to the new revolutionary government, starting schools and institutes and acting as national advisor, which at that time, incidentally, was greatly furthered by the Bolshevik regime and seemed very hopeful for a moment, while there seemed to be a parallelity in the minds of those in power between modern art and the revolution. This favorable climate, the notion that modern art and revolution have something in common, changed, however, and by 1920, certainly the handwriting was on the wall. Kandinsky removed himself from Russia in 1921 and joined the Bauhaus by 1922.
Well, you're ahead of our story again.
All right.
It was almost a rule book in a way. Clay had codified his lectures in the Pädagogische Skizzenbuch.
Right.
And they tried to set explicit values for space and color.
That's right. That's a good way to put it.
Thank you.
And of course, this also fitted into the general Bauhaus notions. The Bauhaus people were fairly pedagogical and concerned with a deliberate and systematic approach.
There was a great deal of pictorial unity in all that was coming out of the Bauhaus at that time. I know there are certain pictures of Kandinsky's that could be Clay's, especially to the untutored eye, and vice versa. What would you say is unique about Kandinsky during this period?
Well, to me, the differences were always much greater than the similarities. It is true that around 1930, Kandinsky and Clay were sometime tantalizingly close to each other, but I never find it difficult to distinguish between the one and the other, and even less likely would it be to confuse Kandinsky with anyone else. Certainly, it doesn't look like Johannes Itten, he certainly doesn't look like Schlemmer, anyone I can think of. So I would think that while Kandinsky fitted into a broad general outline of the Bauhaus, he remained very much himself in his painting and in his thinking.
I didn't mean to imply that Kandinsky could be mistaken for anyone else, except, to my mind, Clay.
Once in a while, but it's a fluke more than anything else.
I think we have to move on to the Paris years now. Again, war, Hitler closing the Bauhaus in 1933, and Kandinsky once again has to uproot himself and move on to Paris.
Right. The Bauhaus was closed in 1933, and the only reasonable thing that Kandinsky could do, of course, under these circumstances, with all of his colleagues dispersing themselves throughout the world is to flee Germany another time and move to Paris for the last 11 years of his life. He worked and painted quietly between 34 and 44 when he died, developing a style which in many ways seems a summary of what he has done throughout his life. I don't mean to suggest that there was a deliberate synthesis of everything that preceded this period, but it is clear as you look at the late Kandinsky's that the rigorousness of the Bauhaus period begins to relax somewhat, that certain subjects and certain forms abandoned during the Bauhaus stretch come back in a new context, and that Kandinsky, now old and wise, is creating a ultimate pictorial language which becomes a testimony of his entire creative contribution.
I think one of the most interesting things about this period is a certain return to representationalism. After all, he had spent so many years eschewing the real in painting, the object, and in some of the later paintings we find a return to these little symbols. For instance, one in the Guggenheim has a recognizable wheel and a ladder. Would you comment on that?
Well, there is this. I don't think that it's a return, because there's a world of difference, of course, between his pictorial early phrase and the emblematic way in which he uses figurative content in his late years. But it is true that certain favorite subjects, like the rider, which remained with him throughout his life, finds a way back in an emblematic form that proves the continuity of his thinking and the continuity of his formal development, even though it allows for considerable changes and evolutions, which we have briefly sketched.
You say the rider. Where does one find the rider in the late Paris years?
There is a painting, I think one that is considered the last painting that he ever did. It's in the collection of Nina Kandinsky, and was in the Guggenheim show, which surveyed Kandinsky's total work in, I believe, 1963. Essentially abstract conception, we suddenly see a small human figure on a horse.
Because the horse and rider is almost the theme of the one continuing thread of Kandinsky's oeuvre.
Yes, it is. It is a theme that certainly has obsessed him, if you wish, from the moment of his artistic maturity to his death.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have. But before we leave, I want to remind our listeners that the entire collection of Kandinsky's owned by the Guggenheim is being exhibited at the Guggenheim until September 5th, and then most of the works go on to the County Museum in Los Angeles, where they can be seen from October 30th on. I might add that this collection is one of the largest and most comprehensive in the world, and one of the most beautiful. And now I want to thank Mr. Thomas Messer, director of the Guggenheim Museum, for having been with us this evening, and to our audience, good night.